What's up, everybody? Appreciate you checking out Urban Legends Podcast, where we interview living legends and people making legendary moves. But yo, I just got on Patreon. That's right, Justin Hyers is officially on Patreon. Man, I'm showing y'all everything. Exclusive content, behind the scenes footage of the podcast, behind the scenes footage of me at the music studio, behind the scenes footage of me and my friends and my family life. It's crazy. This is exclusive footage and content you're not going to find on any other site. It's only available on Patreon. Uncensored, unfiltered, pure comedy gold. Patreon, Justin Hyers. Now, check out the latest episode of Urban Legends Podcast.
Boom. What's up, guys?
Man, what's happening, bro?
What it do?
Hey, man, appreciate you. Appreciate you for showing up this time. We appreciate it.
Hey, are we live? We doing this?
We're recording.
Okay, yeah, because your audience deserves to know. I frosted flaked, and I have never done that before. I apologize. I moved yesterday, but also we have a full Monday to Friday shoot next week. And Tahir and I are doing our first live show next Friday. So it was like the perfect storm. And it was on my calendar and everything. But I remember I got on the phone at 11 and I hung up at 4 o'clock. And I was like, something feels weird. Besides me being on the phone for 5 hours straight, something feels off. And then I saw that IG and I was like, I felt so bad. So thanks for having me on again, man. I don't deserve this.
No, man. Absolutely, no, man. Let me tell you. You know, it's an honor because you the first person that flaked. You know, we thought it was gonna be Lil JJ. Fuck you. Well, Big JJ disappeared, and then turns out he had got into a fight the day before. All type of crazy shit. But he made it. He made it.
Oh, he fought somebody and still made it. Okay.
Yeah, but no, man, I want you to know, bro, the reason why I had you on the show, I created this platform. It's something I've been wanting to do for 2 years. But I've been filming, I don't know if you know, I film a show called MacGyver. But I've been filming that show and I haven't had time to actually start this. And during the pandemic, I finally had the opportunity to start this. And it's called Urban Legends because I wanted to celebrate people that I felt like are living legends and making legendary moves, you know, and I feel like you somebody that's definitely making legendary moves. You're somebody that I've been watching from afar, you know, and be like, damn, man, this dude is really getting it in, man. And so that's why I wanted to have you on the platform.
That's really cool. Thank you. That's dope of you to say.
No doubt. And then, so this is my assistant, Lee. He won't be on the main conversation.
What's going on? I'm just here to hit the bleep button on Justin because he drop a lot of motherfuckers. Nah.
No. That's necessary.
And I drop a lot of niggas. He lied. This is an uncensored okay. Conference. He just talking shit. Get your ass off. Lying shit. What you said?
How uncensored is this?
Oh, no, it's uncensored. You say whatever you want to say.
Like people be like, smoking on here?
Oh, man, if you want to smoke, do your shit, man. Fuck. Hell, hey man, you the first flake, you the first smoker.
Okay, let me not do that.
No, fuck it, do it, do you? No,
do that shit. This is Urban Legends. Do that shit.
Urban Legends, bro. Do that shit.
All right, I'm the first for a couple things. Then I'm down.
I be telling people all the time. I'm like, Dave Chappelle is the freest man in America. He definitely the freest black man in America because I've been at his shows and he's smoking cigarettes. And no one gives a shit. The venue doesn't care. The lady that's pregnant in the front row don't give a shit. No one cares that this nigga's smoking.
You don't think Snoop Dogg is freer? Because Snoop literally has if you invite him, he has to smoke, and they bent at the White House. The White House actually let him smoke.
Damn, that's true. Damn. You're right. You might be right.
Snoop is free.
This is what I like about Chappelle too, though. I mean, I guess Snoop probably the same way. He don't do shit that he don't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not. I feel like he's not attached to any. I guess other than Netflix, but he sends them specials whenever he feel like doing it. But I feel like he's not really attached to any corporation. You know.
Yeah, that's true.
So even like a Snoop. You will see him in commercials. I feel like, but he still don't give a fuck though. Snoop say whatever he want to say on his IG.
Attached to a corporation anyway, and And the thing I like about Snoop is that some people dial down their blackness or their personality to work with these brands. And he's Snoop when he's with Martha Stewart. He's Snoop when he's, you know, with Pepsi. He's Snoop at the White House. And it does not change. And I love people like that. I feel like Cardi B is someone like that too.
Absolutely, man. That's something I admire by all of y'all that's doing y'all thing on social media. Which is something that I started out kind of on YouTube, and then I got off YouTube, and then I got back on YouTube, and I was like, what the fuck? But the authenticity, that's something that I'm doing more of now. I'm starting to do more videos and stuff like that to really show authenticity, because I think that's really the key. Consistency and authenticity, I think, is something that what you do and what ADD, that's something that you all are doing very, very well. What do you think about just the point of, because when you just said like dial down your blackness, right? I feel like that's something that a lot of white people don't even understand. That's something that we have to do or feel like we have to do in order to become successful and make certain strides in America. What do you feel about that? Having to dial down your blackness and authenticity and being who you are?
First of all, that was an incredibly well-worded question. I appreciate that. That's fantastic. I was like, man, this is good. In my opinion, like, you remember when BET was black?
Right. You know what I mean? And owned by a black person.
But it was like, it felt like that. You know what I mean? Like, we had staples where if you missed out on this at BET, you were missing out on the culture. You know what I mean? 106 in Park, Rap City, The Basement, like these were shows that if you didn't watch them, you didn't know who was authentically new and hot on the streets. You know what I mean? You didn't know the culture. And that's because of how unapologetically authentic they were. And they lost that as they got more money and because the vision was lost and black people noticed. And I noticed black people noticing, you know? So, when you look at that, you can literally like reverse engineer it and see where the content changed and where we checked out. So when I was, you know, doing shows for All Deaf, I struggled with that because on this side I had the sales team and the branding team being like, we need some clean shows, we need this, we need to not be the N-word, you know what I mean? We need you to dial it back a little bit because we're trying to sell to these people who are almost like, you guys are too black, right? So I tried to play it safe on both sides of the fence. I would give a dad jokes, which is very clean and very sellable, but then I would also do a roast me, you know? And those were opposite sides of the spectrum, which made it so that not only I was playing it safe on the channel, I was playing it safe with my job, you know? Because it's like, you can't tell me I didn't give you this, but I really, in the middle of those, I struggled with authenticity because it's like, I didn't know which show needed to be clean, which show I just wanted to really let them do their thing. And what I liked about it is that when I really let them do their thing and I really dialed back the whole Hollywood director thing and I started letting everybody laugh on my set, that was a huge thing for me because it's like I'm slowly unraveling the rules of everything that you're supposed to do on set. So everything from letting people laugh on set to deciding, you know what, I'm not gonna bleep this out. I'm gonna keep these jokes in and make it a little bit harsher. I'm gonna do this show that I'm not even sure who's gonna sell it, but I really know, I don't know who we would sell this to, but I really know the audience is gonna like it. When I did that enough, it made me nervous because when All Deaf started doing poorly and we could tell that the money was running out, I thought it was my fault. I'm like, oh, I gotta give a hit. So when it closed, as the creative director, I was wondering, like, was I going too much the authentic route? Could I have dialed that back the blackness a little bit more and gave the sales team more of a shot? And that was really something creatively that I struggled with, you know? And it wasn't until recently when the Forbes article got published that I got to have a conversation with the new CEO. And he cleared up a lot of things for me because he kind of talked about more of the business side of things, the things that were above my head and in terms of the executive things and the last regime and stuff that I wasn't included on. And it was just like, it was all these things, like we were in debt and it was all these things that had nothing to do with the shows. But luckily for me, the shows, which is what was acquired in the buy, is what the audience was built around. So now
it's like, king.
It really came full circle because that authentic thing that we the squad and I and the team around us worked so hard on building survived a year, you know, almost 6 months without being closed, and nobody even knew because the videos were so heavily in rotation. And now we're back and people barely even knew we closed. So it was just really reassuring for me that it came so full circle at the end in terms of the authenticity, because I felt like I made the right decision, or we made the right decision, excuse me.
Wow, that's amazing, bro. You know, I had this conversation with one of my friends one time, and I was like, how is it that only African Americans have to dial down our culture being too black? You know, I don't know if I've ever heard somebody saying they're being too Asian or too Hispanic.
Hey, you know why? I think that's because we're in the black culture. So we get directly attacked, or we see people getting attacked. But I've really heard all of those things, you know, but it was usually from somebody else who was Asian. You know what I mean? Like, ah, you're being so Asian right now, because they know in their culture, those stereotypes that seemingly embarrass them. You know what I mean? Like when you see a black dude doing all the extra shit and you're just like, oh, okay, man, like this is, here we go. You know,
he's dribbling a basketball while reciting the Tupac song.
just that ignorant shit where you're just like, bro, sit down. And I've definitely heard white people referred to as too white. But I get what you're saying. It's the most offensive when it's ours. It's the biggest deal with ours. Being too white is funny, you know what I mean? Being too Asian is probably a joke, but being too black could get you you picked over somebody else picked over you at a job interview.
You could lose a job, absolutely. You could not get a loan and all that type of shit. So I want to go, because I want to get into the ADD stuff, but before we get into all of that, I want to like know your background. I wanted to know like where you, because you, for me, you came out of nowhere. It always seems that way. I'm like, I went from never seeing you to just seeing you pop up all the time. Mm-hmm. When the ADD really kicked off. So where did you grow up, and did comedy come into play first, or was it music?
How I fell into this is very interesting, because you know, the job I have didn't exist when I grew up. So it's weird, you know what I mean? I am jealous of those little kids who had pictures of them in a fireman outfit and a fireman hat, and they're like, their whole life, I want to be a fireman, and they become a fireman. You know what I mean? I don't know what that's like, because I've never wanted to do one thing. You know what I mean? There was a period of time where I wanted to do game design. You know, there was a period of time where I wanted to be a pianist and do music. I went to school for music industry with a minor in jazz. So I didn't know if I was going to graduate and be gigging on cruise ships or be managing an artist on the business side. You know what I mean? I had a law, I had a period of time where I was studying law. You know, there was a period of time where I was considering botany. You know what I mean? There was like so many phases that I had that it kind of all perfectly gelled together into this new job that's just creating stuff for multiple people on the internet, because now I get to do all the stuff that I wanted to do in involving gaming growing up, you know, and new stuff that I didn't even know was an option, like being a streamer, you know, that's
right,
fun thing ever. And you know, like music, you know, I went to school for piano, the music business side of thing. I do music. I not only can I incorporate that in the other content that I do, you know, but I can just release that on my channel also. So it's like, it was almost like a potpourri of interests that I would have had to choose one or the other traditionally, but because of social media, it's like you can kind of just do them all at once,
right,
and have an interesting channel, you know? So
what was your hometown?
My bad. That was actually the question.
No. All that was the question too. But I wanted to be like, where's this nigga from? this king. I'm trying to say king more than nigga. But where's this king from?
Thank you. I grew up in Los Angeles.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So I went to but I was all over the place. You know, for middle school, I was going to a performing arts school called Millikan that was in the Valley area. But then on the complete opposite of that, I went to this kind of hood school for high school called Hamilton that was performing arts too, but niggas got shot during summer school. So it was just different, you know. But, you know, and then I went to Cal State Northridge for most of my college, and then I did a year at Musicians Institute for piano. So it was really like a bunch of stuff, and then I took an internship. I was only free for 4 days. I graduated on Tuesday, and I started my internship on Friday.
Wow.
So that's less than 4 days. So I had multiple internships. I had a radio station, and I had I was a music intern at Awesomeness TV. My sister, who worked at Dreamcast, DreamWorks. Mm-hmm. DreamWorks. Yeah, she worked at DreamWorks, and she sent me a job listing for an internship at this YouTube channel called Awesomeness TV.
I remember that.
Yeah, and it was weird because I was like, "How do you intern at YouTube?" Like, I didn't see YouTube as a physically running place yet. And it was cool because I told her, like, I already had the radio internship, and she still sent me the listing. So huge shout out to Darren, because my sister, because I don't know how I would have even found out about this. But I took a shot at it, and it was just this super dope. Everybody was young. The content was terrible. It was like Austin Mahone and all these like white pop stars. So I didn't care for that.
Right.
But I was an intern there, and it was a creative campus. So there was a bunch of companies. There was 17 Magazine. There was a whole bunch of stuff. But towards the end, towards the back in a cold, dark room was all deaf, like a budding all deaf. And, all the interns were like eating lunch and just talking and stuff like that. But one thing that I was told in college is like, once you're out in the field, like, you'll see, like, people will be lazy and be like, slipping up, but stay on it. So instead of eating lunch with the interns, I asked the one girl that I was becoming friends with, Rachel, to show me around. So she kind of showed me around the whole place, introduced me to the vice president of All Deaf at the time. It was a black woman named Aaliyah Williams. And I was there as
Aaliyah.
Mm-hmm. Aaliyah Williams, yeah. Amazing, amazing, amazing producer. She was just like, "What'd you go to college for?" I said, music business. She was like, "Do you need an internship?" I was like, "Okay." Cause I was only at Awesomeness 2 days a week. So I was doing the radio, All Deaf, and Awesomeness at the same time. And just to answer your question about coming out of nowhere, I wasn't talent for, the first few years that I was there. I was signed on as a personal assistant to Aaliyah. I went to PA, then the equipment manager. He bought all this equipment that I've never seen before. I didn't know anything about cameras. And he quit because he went to work on a show. Because in Hollywood, show seasons, they go in and out. So people were sort of like, it was like a rotating door in terms of
producers. That's right. Anyone don't know, I starred on Rush Hour, the TV series. It got canceled during the commercial break. So,
the dark parts of the business too, man. And that's
right.
That's really important. And I was so lucky that, all these producers with knowledge were setting all these things up, because I didn't go to school for all of this. I didn't have the debt of film school, which was great. But these guys were teaching me everything, and they set me up with the equipment and dip to do something else. So I became the equipment manager, and I was just in this small room with cameras and lights and all these things. Cause on set, a director would be like, "Grab me two Kinos and a Stinger." And I'd be like, "Bet." And I'll just Google, what is a Stinger? An extension cord? Why didn't he just say that? You know what I mean? It was so hectic, but it was dope because it was like a playground, and I got to just learn all of these things. And when I got the shot to produce, I got to produce. So I wasn't out of nowhere, because I was really learning every step of the business behind the scenes. But then when I met King Kieran and Simone Shepherd and all these influencers who just came and were shooting around and editing really quickly, and they had me shooting the stuff and jumping in with them. And then I saw an invoice of theirs from Hyundai or something for a Vine. It was 6 second Vine. And I was like, this is lucrative. You know what I mean? Like, right. And then I was just like,
What was the ballpark figure? If you don't, or you don't want to say, you don't have to say, you don't want to say.
It was enough for a nice car.
Hey, that's good enough for me.
it was enough for a really nice
car. You know, we actually have some similarities, man, because I went to a performing arts high school. We also got nigga shot.
What city are you from?
St. Petersburg, Florida.
Okay.
Yeah, so Tampa Bay area. So yeah, yeah, I went to a
school. Dangerous.
Our niggas got shot too, and I went to, and then I also interned at a radio station because I went to college in Atlanta, Clark Atlanta University, and so I interned at V103, which is hip hop.
Okay.
Yeah, hip hop and R&B. So yeah, so that's cool just to hear that. So okay, so that was cool. That was information that I never knew about you, which was dope. What was the moment when you say you got to be a producer? When did they allow you ADD to say, okay, Patrick, we believe in you. We're going to allow you to now produce content. Or did you approach them and say, yo, I got some dope ideas. I would love to try to produce something for your channel.
So at the time I was the equipment manager, and Russell, who was a very, very big and vocal part of the company at the time, his dream for All Def was sort of like a playground for comedians and upcoming talent. He wanted sort of just like an open door for comedians to come in, hang out, shoot stuff and stuff like that, which is dope, you know, in theory. Right. Once that actually starts happening, then it becomes like, okay, security risks. There are people trying to get work done. So it at one point got too much and we had to scale back. But at first it was exactly that. And all these dope comedians like Slink Johnson walked in. And at the time I'm like, Black Jesus, holy crap. Right now, that was so long ago that it's like, that's, you know, that's Slink, that's the homie. But like at the time it was just like Black Jesus would come into the office, take his shirt off, put a wrestling mask on, and walk through the editors yelling stuff and cussing. And, you know, he's really funny white editors. And he'd just be like, what's up, nigga? What's this trip? Smoke yours. Where's your weed? And in my mind, I'm sitting next to all these equipment. I'm looking around at the producers like, why is nobody shooting this? You know, this is funny. So I kind of just took it upon myself because it was a very free environment, as you can see. You know, he was smoking and stuff. And people were messing up. You know, there were interns that were getting fired because they, Slink would be like, you trying to smoke? And they'd be like, okay, cool. And then, you know, somebody would need their supervisor be like, where's so-and-so? And you're like, oh, they're out smoking. You know, because people were so excited by this life. But right. I was just like, yo, I gotta stay focused. I was, you know, arranging painters to paint, you know, all of the executives' walls with this EXO stuff so you could write on the walls.
Wow.
So that was like that's how I got cool with all of them, because once I found that paint, I was like, yo, we should, you know, if everybody writes on the wall, everybody wanted that. So I was going to Lowe's and Home Depot and paying these painters and getting into these executive offices. So by that time they trusted me enough to, if I was just like, yo, I'm gonna grab a camera and sound, do all the shit myself. I would record little skits around the office because Slink wanted to work. A lot of these comedians, they wanted to work too. But the producers there were just, you know, in their own world and had their own responsibilities. So I just want
to remind Slink that I beat his ass on BET show Black Car Revolt. I'm blacker than you, nigga. Huh?
Was it one-on-one or was it like a panel?
It was like a panel. It was like celebrities. I guess they considered us celebrities. and like we had like people that weren't celebrities, and we teamed up and we had to answer questions about black shit, and I won both of my episodes. Slink, you thought you was a real one, and I beat your black ass. All right, I'm back.
that's impressive, because Slink is literally one of the blackest people I know.
I know, that's why I took so much pride in it. I know.
Slink's one of those people you go out in public and you're like, all right, can you dial down your black? Like,
exactly.
No, I'm just kidding. Huge shout out to Slink. But you know, they let me edit the stuff together and post it, and it would do well. And so I was also like already getting paid. So, you know, a lot of opportunity at All Def came from, we had no money. You know, you could go back and see our early stuff. We were shooting in a garage. We were holding sound because there was traffic outside and people were honking at each other. Like, it was really like some dirt stuff. But I loved that, because a lot of producers who came from these rich, fancy Hollywood production things, and they only know how to produce if they had $1 million budget.
Right.
And they didn't know how to get a skit done because they were trying to figure out a trailer for the talent. And we were like, that's why that didn't get approved, because you're looking for it. You know what I mean? Like, you got to bare bones it. And I wasn't coming from anywhere. I was a blank slate. So I was able to do it however we needed it to be done money-wise. So
do you all have trailers now?
No, still no.
Still no. I'm gonna tell you a funny story about ADD. So at the time when ADD first started, I was thriving on YouTube. I was kind of popping. Hey, look at Patrick. We gonna wait to that. Look at that bar.
Oh. I didn't know we were doing stuff. Wow.
You know what I'm saying? Russell Simmons approached me. Somehow he found out about me because I had some videos. I used to do like some videos on YouTube and some of them used to go viral or whatever. So Russell Simmons asked me to come to his house. You know, we sitting by the pool. You know, he started caressing my thigh. I'm joking. He didn't do that. I'm joking. So me and Russell talking. And what'd you say?
Is that what he said? He was like, how you feeling today, Justin?
Yeah, exactly. fun story, though. He did have a never mind. I'm not going to go there. So anyways, he was nice to me. And he wanted me to start doing content for ADD. This is the very beginning of ADD. I don't even know if they had even put out a video yet. This is like the very, very foundation of ADD.
Spoken Reasons era, yeah.
Spoken Reasons era, which I had on the podcast. So so that's a whole nother story. But here was my issue with ADD at the time. I was already kind of thriving on YouTube, getting views. And they were saying how they was going to own all of my content. I didn't know if they was going to have any type of percentage. At the time, it was no percentage splits. It was just like, nah, whatever you create, we go own it. And so at the time, I'm like, well, I'm already getting millions of views on my videos. Worldstar is always posting my shit. So I'm thinking, well, why am I going to go let y'all get my shit and I don't have any type of ownership? So that's why you never seen a Justin Hires in the early stages of ADD. That was the reason because, you know, when he at the same time they was approaching like Spoken Reasons, they was hollering at me too.
Yeah.
So I said all that to ask, now, do you maintain any type of ownership? Do you get any type of percentage split from the content you create? Or is that still something that they don't really do there at so ADD?
You know, that is something that is new with this new regime. They never really gave us a chance to do that. The thing with All Def, and I don't want to badmouth any eras of it because it was all a big learning process. But the frustrating thing is that there's only like three or four of us that do the production and, you know, sort of like the executive side of things and are on camera. So we are like the face that people blame for really everything. Right. And people think that we made every decision on the business level of All Def since it started, you know what I mean? And that was something that came in the last few years, if that. And even on the top level of all those decisions, it wasn't us, you know? But we kind of get blamed for every regime, and these new leaders come in, kind of like get bad relationships with talent and all this stuff, and then they'll leave to another company, but that talent is just like, fuck ADD, you know what I mean? So right. We got the weight on us, so people don't like us for things that we had nothing to do with. So it's very frustrating because like even when I first started there, Dormtainment, who are the nicest guys ever and are friends of mine, they didn't like All Def because of some fallout that they had. So when the first regime change happened, we had to go in and reconnect with some people and be like, all right, you know, certain people aren't here anymore, blah, 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 blah. You know, things are different now. So it was always like a kind of like a tornado in terms of like relationships with talent. But I would say that in this new regime, they are giving us an opportunity to get, you know, splits of the ads of the podcast, you know what I mean? Splits of the IPs, because they're also smart enough to, they have a lot of bigger plays to the point where they're not gonna nitpick on that type of stuff, which they shouldn't be. You know, the last couple regimes were kind of more adamant about like, we have everything, we own everything, you know what I mean? Towards the end, there were like some talks about merch splits, but it was never really anything substantial. But now it does feel like a little bit more free and it makes a lot more sense.
Gotcha. Well, that's good to hear for y'all, because I'm thinking about, you know, just the content that you created you know, and you just don't want to hear one of them stories. You go off somewhere and they own all your shit, which the good thing about you, you're a creator, so you go create other stuff. But just to make sure that, you know, you being compensated, you don't want no TLC situation.
Like, right. Yeah. I'm really, really adamant about that. Because I love the idea of owning IP, because you can do whatever you want with it, keep the same name and change it, you know? And like this past summer, shout out to Caffeine Network. I got the pleasure of working with a new upcoming streaming service that's kind of like a competing with Twitch, and it's Caffeine. It's kind of like it has like more of a hip hop vibe. They just had a bunch of shows like Drake and Offset, so it's sort of like that vibe. And I sold them like a gaming / debate show called Battle Club, and it took a minute and it took a lot of contract rewrites, but I was really adamant about it having in plain English that I own the IP and can do with what once the season ends with you guys, I can do whatever with it, you know? And it took a little bit of back and forth, but they were really cool about it. And I was able to not only get paid to air it on Caffeine, but then I was able to download all those episodes and then put them on my own personal channel. So
nice.
I'm starting to try to figure out a formula and a method that I can just lock into and take that to every company that I work with, because at the end of the day, I just want to creatively consult or give ideas to people, you know, if it makes sense and if it's fair.
No, absolutely. I mean, you know, that's what Tyler Perry always preaches, is ownership, you know. So I definitely think that's the key, and that's what I'm trying to do even with the stuff that I'm doing. Hey, so roast me and dad jokes, which one came first?
I believe roast me came first, but roast me was a long burn. You know, it didn't really blow up until the third season. And then dad jokes was just right out the gate. You know, the first episode was on the news. So like,
damn, that's crazy.
Very quick. So dad jokes, I feel like it seems like it was out longer because it was popping for longer, but roast me was a minute ago back. You know, a lot of people don't know don't remember the first season, cause it wasn't great, but it was where I got my bearings. It was like my first big production. But it looked like we were in hell. I don't know what was up with the set. It literally looked like we were in hell. It was like a rotating spit. That one did okay. But I didn't get the rhythm until the marketing, which is an interesting story. The way I marketed it ended up being the actual format that I used. People liked how I market it better than the actual finished product.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Explain that.
Okay. So when Roast Me started, basically roasting had bubbled up as a culture within the office. You know, we had Teddy Ray and Doughboy roasting each other. We had Tony Hinchcliffe coming through and roasting people. To hear more added, he's from St. Louis. He was roasting people. We had a couple shows called like Kids, White People Roast for the Old First Time, Old People Roast for the First Time, stuff like that. And roasting became like this is kind of tight. So the CEO knew that we needed a roasting show, and unrelated, he wanted a game show. So I was just like, okay, I'm gonna create a roasting game show. And I wrote it like a game show. And it's really tough to create a game, because you make it and you're like, this is cool. And then you play it and you find out all the stuff that's wrong with it.
Right.
You know, like all the pieces don't fit together. So we kind of got it down. We did a couple of rehearsals, but it was very like formulaic, you know what I mean? It was very like, this was how you said you had a joke, and then the audience, the host would call on you, and you would attack the person. The dude who was on the hot seat was on a rotating spit. Shout out to Sydney Kim, that was a suggestion from him. But yeah, it was very like, you roast, you roast.
Right.
So, and, you know, and there was a whole bunch of other things. I rented this studio out for 3 days straight. And it was a cold year, but for some reason, those 3 days were the hottest days of the year. It was like upper 90s. And the studio, their AC was broken. So the first day, I was in there with the set designers making the set. Sweaty mess. Second day, setting the cameras with the production team. Third day was the shoot day. And I promised All Def I could shoot 9 episodes to make the budget make sense. So It's this hot, sweaty, you know, nasty place. The comedians are hot. You could see them. If you watch the first season, you see Teddy sweating like a dog. And like
I think Teddy sweats without the AC.
That is true. No, he sweats all the time. Right. It was like legitimately hot. But I was nervous. I was like I wasn't letting the crew laugh. I was like, shh, you know what I mean? I was a tyrant. I didn't know how to run a set. I was doing a million things at once. And I was just like forcing the funny. I was like, come on, like, let's go until we get a big laugh. You know, it was just like, it was very, very forced. But then we shot those. And I did all the heavy lifting to save money. I rented the cameras, the lights, all that, the spit. So I remember loading all that in the truck by myself and just going home and weeping. I wept. I never wept until I shot Roast Me. Cause I was like, I put everything into this and it sucked.
Damn.
And so we edited the videos and I was like, these are okay. And so when the marketing came, I basically had everybody sit in the break room and it was just free. It wasn't, I lost the whole this thing. We went live. I had the phone. I had a phone, and I was just freely letting them roast across the room. And I just knew everybody's name, so I would go to and that's how I marketed the first season. So they hadn't seen the first season yet. They saw this free, authentic roasting game that felt like you were in the class with your homies, right?
Right.
And then I marketed. People were like, "This is about to be the best shit ever! Best shit ever!" We air the first episode, niggas is. Niggas was like, okay, this is kind of funny, you know,
right?
Because I stacked it so that the funniest episodes were episodes 1 through 4. And then it just got to the point where people were like, I liked how we marketed it. So, all right, bet. Season 2 was all live, you know, with me with a phone. Then season 3, we got camcorders and we were, you know, doing it like that. And at the time I was jumping in content more because I had been building my own audience since the King Kieran Simone thing that I was talking about. And I started jumping in my own shows because we needed people. Like the first episodes of Great Taste, the first 4 had producers in there that never came back because they weren't talent, you know? I was just on the fence, me and Denzel. So we would be doing stuff like that and getting popular on Great Taste. So I was heavily requested on Roast Me, but I didn't want to do Roast Me. I was just like, I'm not talent, you know? But Meg, it wasn't until Meg came on board for season 3 where she forced me off the camera. We got camera and then I built the classroom. And that's when everything sort of from season 1 and 2 and the marketing came to like a just like the perfect, like that was like the perfect storm for what it was.
Yeah, man. You know, Brandon Lewis is my homeboy. Phenomenal comedian. I told him soon as I saw like the first episode, I don't know which episode I seen first. It was definitely already in the classroom. I hit him up and I said, this is the funniest fucking show online right now. I said, bro, and I'm tough. I'm a tough critic, bro. You know what I'm saying? I've been doing stand-up comedy for 13 years. I done did shows with some of the greats. I am a tough comedic critic. And when I said, this is the funniest show online, period. And I meant it. I still mean it. That show is phenomenal. What made you hire, or who hired Brandon Lewis? How did he even get that job as the host of that show?
First of all, huge shout out to Brandon Lewis. He probably has one of the greatest character arcs on All Def channel history, because it's funny. I met him as a complete wreck of a producer. I was brand new. I was nervous about everything. I had my first big production where it was black people go ice skating for the first time. So I got to rent out an ice rink. Like, we bought it out. It was just ours. You know, spent all this money. We had Teddy Ray, some dude, and B. Lou. It's my first time working with B. Lou. Day of, he calls me. I got an audition. Can't make it. I was like, yo, what the hell? So nothing against B. Lou, because I didn't know him at the time, right. But as a producer, I was freaking out. So we literally banned B. Lou. Like, it was like he was like the first person we blacklisted. But then, like, he's hilarious. So when people are that funny, like, it finds a way. You know, nobody
and he won his episode of Yo Mama, the MTV show.
He's hilarious. So it's like, we weren't sitting there like, fuck Brandon Lewis, but in terms of like, as a producer, when we were casting, it's like, names come with reps. So it's just like, he was like that dude who didn't show up, right? You know, everybody kind of had like a profile when it came to casting, right? So it's crazy because eventually he was just integrated back into things because he's funny. But the reason why he's hosting, he was always a strong roaster because he was always just a contestant, right? Teddy quit live on air.
Teddy was the first host, wasn't he?
Teddy was the first host, and he was a pretty good host, but he didn't really like, he liked roasting Doughboy. You know, that was something I didn't really understand. He wasn't a roaster. Like, at the time when I was making a Roast Me show, I wasn't thinking of, like, when I direct now, I think of it as, like, being a quarterback. Like, everybody, like has a different position, you know, as opposed to thinking that everybody can do the same thing. So I was just like, Teddy, you're good at roasting. Roast. And he was just like, I'd be roasting Doughboy because we cool. I didn't understand, like, the intricacies of it. So he was kind of not into it. You know, he said it was like it was just kind of like stale, the same thing every week. He had his own reasons, right?
Hold on, before you get to that, how did he quit live? Was it a joke that hurt him, or he was just like, this is stupid, and then he just walked off?
He said, and you know, like I said, I don't really be putting behind the scene business.
I feel you.
But at the same time, this happened on camera, you know, and I was like very, very affected by that. You know, that was not a cool thing for me. You know, he basically, we were live and he was just like, I'm not doing this no more. And walked off. That's how it happened. Damn. So in my mind, I felt some type of way because I was such a huge fan of Teddy, you know, and I remember the first time I saw him do stand up, I was like, I want to make a show for this guy. I want to do something with this guy, you know?
Incredible stand up.
Yeah, and I you know, as soon as I got the opportunity for the show, I pulled him aside and I gave it to him. So for it to end like that was just very, it was very real for me. It definitely changed how I work with talent, you know? Mm. But yeah, that happened and I was just kind of like, all right, the show needs to shift. It has to shift because I'm not the nigga to convince somebody to come back. Straight especially, up. You know what I mean? Especially if I feel offended. So I pivot and I felt like I needed somebody who had three things. Not only could have a good hosting presence and cause that's a skill. There's a lot of funny people who can't host. A big hosting personality, but also can roast themselves. And that's hard to do too, because a lot of times when you're very chiseled and focused on hosting, teleprompter, when the roasting comes, it's just like, what part of the script is this, you know? So you needed those two things, which was tough enough, but I also needed that third thing, which was a very iconic laugh. And that was a big gap because Teddy's laugh is top tier. You know, we want him at every comedy show. Right. So B-Lou's laugh mixed with how big of a personality he was on stage and on Roast Me, and the fact that he was one of the strongest roasters, it made sense. But we also, you know, a lot of people remember there was like a cool month where every week was a different host, right? And there was a couple, it was between him and Tahir. Tahir was a really good Roast Me host. But he was involved with All Deaf in other ways. So it was like a way to mix it up, but also keep it so that the people who were on the drop and, you know, the Kevs and all that stuff weren't like attached to the show. And you know what I mean? So it almost made Roast Me its own entity, which is dope because a lot of people know about Roast Me. Me but don't know about All Deaf, which is cool. It outgrew, same with Dad Jokes, you know, it kind of outgrew the channel. So yeah, that was kind of like the birth of B-Lou as the host, and that's really when the show found itself too. It because it's like B-Lou's connection to these comedians and the fact that these comedians actually are out there roasting each other. It's not like they just like, all right, roast me, it's time just to do this. Like, they're actually out there roasting with people. So it's like they, it's a really fun experience because those guys, all that whole group of guys is just like a ball of talent. And anytime you're around them, it's a good time. So it's really easy for me. All I do is just shoot them.
Yeah, I told B. Lewis, I said, I would never be on that show because I'm a Cancer and I'm sensitive and I'd be done punch somebody in the eye at the end of that goddamn show. I can't take it. I wouldn't be able to take it. But for me to watch it, I think it's the fucking funniest show. How do you go about casting the comedians that you use for a show like Roast Me and some of this? Because I'm sure there's a lot of comedians that would love to be on the show. And but how would you go about casting that? Or how do you go about casting that?
That's been for sure a journey. The first season of Roast Me, it was funny because I cast it like how you would cast a movie. It was really weird. Like I'd have them all five, you know, sit in. I'd be like, you two come in. They'd roast. Like I, you know what I mean? It was
nice. It was very,
and you know where I put the ad up? I put the ad up on LA Casting. these were actors, and this is when I really learned the business. I learned that actors get the booking and just go, and then they literally will show up and be like, "What's this for?" And it's like, fam, how unprofessional is that? You didn't even know what this was.
Right.
So now you have these actors who either weren't prepared and they're just sitting there like, I can't roast, I, you know? And, or you have these people from LA Casting who are like, yeah, roasting, that sounds like a good thing. And then they're just trying it out for the first time. Right. So it wasn't until I was like, okay, that's not how I can only find roasters through word of mouth. You know, people who have roasted with other people. So that's why it's really important for producers to be in there with talent. Like a lot of times producers just in their office, they hit, you know what I mean? And they just pick people who they think would be good for a project and just they're surprised when they yell action, you know, it's like, if you are friends with these people or you're going to these clubs and talking to these people and really like in the mix with them, your work is going to be better because you know exactly. So it wasn't until I was like meeting these people and knowing who was and actually asking them, you know, like that's big for me. Like I'll ask B. Lou and Craig, like, who do you want on the show? You know,
right.
And that's better than just me having like, all right, here's the waiting room, roast them, you know? So.
Man, Craig Smith, man, that's somebody that I came up in with in the comedy scene doing open mics. And, you know, he would do these characters and stuff like that, you know. But it wasn't until I saw him on Roast Me that I was like, oh, shit, that's your true fucking gift. Like, mm-hmm. Who knew? I had no clue he was a roaster because it's so off the wall. It's so it's genius, you know. And I'm like, how did he come up with this weird insult?
Eat gummy bear salsa, like the pieces of that joke I don't get it, you know what I mean? Like I could try to figure out how some people like, oh, I could see how he thought of that, but like there's some of these things that it's just like I got nothing.
Hey, so how did you come up with dad jokes? I know you were saying how the CEOs wanted you to have certain shows, but what was the genesis? What was like, okay, I'm a know about dad jokes and create this into a show?
Well, I guess technically the genesis would be back in college, me being obsessed with people breaking character and then trying to get back. Like, I'm a huge fan of The Office. That's like my comedy Bible. So I was such a big fan, I would just put on the blooper reels because I myself wasn't an actor, but I liked finding out about other art forms. Like I did stand up all throughout college with no intentions of being a stand up comedian. I just loved being in a green room and seeing comedians talk about jokes the same way that musicians are in the green room talking about songs. I loved the connection, you know, being a musician around comedians. So it was the exact same thing with that kind of stuff. So I didn't know much about acting, but to see a character like a Dwight, who is like this, you know, very, very detailed character, think something is funny in a scene and break character like, oh, dude, that was hilarious. And you're like, what voice is that? And then you see them snap back. Like, I love stuff like that. I love watching Whose Line Is It Anyway? All those, you know, and I didn't invent anything new. Like, You Laugh, You Lose has been a challenge online forever. You know, the corny jokes thing has been a challenge online. So it was, what I feel like what I brought to it was two things. I kept them in. You know, every You Laugh, You Lose challenge is once you laugh, it's either over or that person is gone, you know? Right. But I really liked the Office blooper reel approach, which was breaking character of somebody you like seeing online and then trying to get it back, you know? Mm. And then naturally, that led to keeping score. So it was really like those two adjustments that made it pop. But then I think the third thing was having original comedians writing original jokes. You know what I mean? Like, how many times are people gonna turn the camera on and say the same popsicle stick jokes? You know, like corny jokes has been a thing forever, and it's been like the same 300.
Right. So
once we had a mix of original jokes, like that first episode with Kev versus Tony, it was so raw. We didn't even have the text jokes in, you know, now we have like all the text, but a mix between like newer jokes. I don't think he wrote this, but the like, how do you find Will Smith in the snow? You look for Fresh Prince. Like that's a little bit more modern. I don't think he wrote that, but then that mixed with the ridiculous things that Tony was originally writing. That's what made it its own thing, you know? And I feel like just those small adjustments, was immediately appreciated by the internet, and I'm sent like, it's almost, I don't know if this is like to like pat me on the back or be like aha, but like people will send me like the French version of dad jokes, or like a board game, or like a card game that somebody made in Spain of dad jokes, and it will have like literally original jokes from the show in it.
Well, see, that was the whole reason why I was asking about ownership, you know, because that was something. Yeah, oh shit. But that's the whole reason I even asked that question originally, though, because I know, like, for instance, I sold a show to CBS a while ago, and the first thought out of the exec mind was, oh, okay, well, we just need to switch it up so we could sell it to Europe, and we want to have this same show in Europe, and we want to have the same show in Australia. They're automatically thinking globally the other money that they could make off of that same, you know, IP, intellectual property,
like,
anybody.
American Idol. There's American Idol, like Spain, American Idol, London, you know what I mean? Like and it's different hosts, different everything. At that point, you just are selling the IP. And then you have something that happens like The Voice. The Voice is American Idol, but the chairs are turned around. Right. A small adjustment, boom, 30 seasons. You know what I mean? It's a very interesting game.
Who was the first big name celebrity that y'all had, other than Russell Simmons? Who was the big first celebrity that you all had on ADD or on a show that you created?
Oh, on a show that I made. That's tough because Roast Me and Dad Jokes were like our seventh or eighth show.
Mm-hmm.
There's like a lot of, I don't know. I would say that the standouts were when, I don't know which was first. The moments was definitely Will Ferrell versus Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah, classic.
Yeah, because I just remember looking at that like, what is happening right now? Cedric the Entertainer versus Tracy Morgan was amazing. And also definitely going against Sam Jackson, the original Shaft, and Regina King, like that was amazing.
How did y'all even go about reaching out to them? Or what? How did y'all reach out to them, or did they publicists reach out to you? What was the dynamics of even getting them?
So that was the cool thing about Dad Jokes was that it was popular, but it was also Black. So we had a lot of movies reach out to us because they feel like we had the Black demo. Wow. And that was it was almost like an affirmative action way in, but I did not mind because right. Here I was walking into like a Fox movie lot with slides on. Everybody's looking at me like who is this, you know, 20 something year old kid like what, like it was a great feeling because I felt it. Everybody was like, "What are you doing here?" And I'm like, "Yep, action," you know. And it was cool because I got to experience like some very very major parts of the business that I didn't feel like I don't know how else I would have gotten in there. So it's like when something like Daddy's Home 2 comes out and Universal will reach out to us like, "Yo, we can provide talent, or can you just do an activation for us, like with your talent, but it's like, you know, brought to you by this." So there's just different deals that were coming in, but the money was cool, but I wasn't seeing any of it. So like the cool thing for me was when we could use their talent, you know? So right. that was sort of just like the way, you know, we were able to work with John Cena, who I watched wrestling, you know, growing up. So it was just like, it was movie studios hitting us up to get the black demo. So that kind of gave us a lot of black movies too. Like we were doing like This Christmas, Shaft, you know what I mean? Like Tracy Morgan's show. So we definitely got a lot of black projects, but you know, every now and then we would get like a white project like Daddy's Home 2.
How do you see yourself? Because when I look at you from afar, you know, outside looking in, I view you as like this new age Keenan Ivory Wayans, Lorne Michaels, type person, you know, that's really got their finger on the pulse of comedy and the culture. How do you feel about yourself, or what lens do you kind of see or space do you see yourself in?
This is probably the hardest stuff to answer because I don't know.
Right.
I don't know. I'm so like, it's weird because I feel like I'm so creative and my mind is so busy that I'm also airheaded, you know? Like it's a very weird thing. Like there's a whole thing that Tony always saying, "I don't know anything," because it's just like very basic things that I'm just like, "What's that?"
And what's a computer?
And yeah, it's I think it's just because I'm so like head down doing all of these things that some of my self-awareness is off, especially image. You know, self-awareness in terms of like, you know, how I feel and how I feel about other things is for sure on point. But I'm image-wise, I don't know, because I just feel like I do what I like instead of doing things to uphold an image. And I was just talking to a painter. I love talking to painters. I was just talking to this painter. His name is Javier Sandoval. And we were talking about...
he sounded like he could paint good.
Right? Great name. We were talking about what somebody's style is. And it's like, we were talking about painting, but it's like, there are people who try to have a style and they'll be like, "Okay, my thing is hedgehogs. I'm gonna put a hedgehog in all of my paintings. You know what I mean? That's my thing." And then there are people that just they just do stuff. And then they look back on it and then they see that there's patterns and they're like, "Oh, I do that a lot." Right. That's really a style. You know what I mean? And it's when either someone else analyzes it or if you kind of look back and you just like, "Oh, that is," you know what I mean? I feel like that's an authentic style as opposed to like, "Oh, I gotta do this because that's my thing," or "I gotta do this because that's my style." You know, I feel like if you just do like authentically, then your style will probably be told to you, if that makes sense.
Right. No, that makes perfect sense. Couple more questions, man. I'm gonna let you go, man. I appreciate your time. Oh, okay, cool. I literally just saw this yesterday, and I don't know how true it is. Somebody had wrote that Kev on stage left ADD. What mm-hmm. is that true? And if so, like, what does that mean exactly?
Okay. So before we closed, he was the head of content. I was the creative director, and Meg was the head of operations. Right. So he ran the channel. I did I made the shows. Meg did the budgets and all of the most difficult stuff.
Gotcha.
He got into a weird position because All Def the signs were, the shit was written on the walls for a very long time. You know what I mean? It was like a very slowly sinking ship. Our finance people kept leaving and we were like,
they know first.
Right? So there was a couple of scares where, you know, Kev would be in meetings all day and then he'd come out and it would be like, because Kev was always very, very real with us. You know, he always promised us like there would be no surprises. If I know something, I'm going to straight up tell them, like, I got to tell my people. So right. Huge shout out to Kev because he was just a very good leader. You know, he was also doing all of this all deaf stuff while on a full world tour that he was headlining. He would headline in 3 cities. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then be at work on Monday and then leave, bring his luggage to work on Friday. It was like, I didn't understand how crazy that was until looking back at it, but he was already sort of like popping, you know, it was like this weird, like employee, but a star medium. So when things got rocky, there was a couple times where he was like, I think this is it. Like, I think we're going to be done by the end of the month. Get everything together. We were just like, shoot, like, you know, get everything. And then like a week later, he'd be like, okay, we're good, you know? So that happened like a couple of times, but then there was one that was very serious to the point where Kev wasn't even sure. So he was like, okay, if it's over, I'm booking the rest of this year out. Cause I'm gonna just be sitting around. So right. He booked the rest of the year of his tour. And then they came back and was like, you're good. And he was just like, fam, like, Even now that I know I'm good, I booked all this stuff, I'm not even going to really be here, mm-hmm. you know? And I didn't know. He told me way later. He was already priming me while he was on tour because he was kind of giving me his responsibilities. I didn't know it at the time. Gotcha. But he was sort of priming me to the point where I was kind of doing his job for about a year, 6 months to a year before it was official. So, yeah, he technically did leave All Deaf because he, you know, and he called us all and made us all perfectly, you know, sure that it wasn't anything. Like, it was just, he was just like, I'm just trying to strike while the iron's hot. Like, I don't know if I'm gonna get this chance again. And it's a good thing he did, because, you know, you see him now, but he's still very, very involved in All Deaf. He's just, you know, he got Kev on Studios, he got his new Keep Your Distance show. It's a lot going on, but, you know, he's still part of Squadcast. We're still involving him in the shoot, all the shoots that we do if he's available. But just in terms of like how he was classically involved, yes, he left All Deaf back before we closed. That's what the person who was talking to you was probably talking about.
Right.
But I wouldn't consider him like all the way back. It's sort of like he's in it when he is, but he's kind of doing his own thing too.
Dope. So when All Deaf did shut down for that, so what? Two things. When Russell Simmons and the Me Too thing happened, did that kind of also, was that part of ADD closing down, or was it strictly the financial situation?
It was everything. It was everything. I wouldn't blame it on one thing.
Right.
It was a mix between everything. But I will say when that movement happened, we were hit very, very hard. It's like, you know, the people we were used to seeing around on the highest level weren't around anymore because they were out putting out fires, you know, and the whole, you know, I don't want to get too much into it, but
right.
It was a lot of deals that we lost. You know, we did kind of become a black sheep in terms of working with other companies. And that it did slow the money down. There was a couple projects that were lost, you know, a couple deals that were pending that were lost. So yeah, it did have an impact. Was that the sole reason? Absolutely not, you know. But it was a very interesting time at All Deaf.
And how were you personally handling that? Just that time, were you like concerned, like, oh shit, like all this work I've done, like I don't know what my future gonna be? Or you like, that's cool because I got other stuff that I'm working on? Or did you not have anything else lined up?
The Me Too time or when it closed?
Oh, so those is two different. See, I thought those was kind of around the same time.
It happened a cool 2-3 years before we closed.
Oh, damn. That's crazy.
Yeah, because, I mean, it
So the happened. Time... Well, my bad. The time it closed. Not the Me Too time, but the time it closed.
When it closed, It was very scary. I actually, the first thing I did here's what's interesting. When it closed, I was in the middle of the best project I had ever been allowed to do. I created this show called Working Wild for Tony Baker.
Oh yeah.
I'm obsessed with Anthony Bourdain shows, travel shows, food shows. Like, that's ideally what I would want to do, right? So I studied those shows, and then, you know, had to deal with Facebook, and, you know, everybody wanted to do an animal show with Tony, but it was probably going to be, he does the voiceovers, it's probably going to be the same idea pitched to him. So we kind of pitched him like a Dirty Jobs with animals.
Right.
So I was working with a animal manager, a Hollywood animal manager. This was the lady who you went to for every exotic animals, pet animals, animal groomers. She just knew animal actors, all that stuff. So I was going with her to like farms that had beekeepers and hanging out with a beekeeper all day and learning about bees. And then I would go and hang out with a falconer all day. We were scouting all these amazing places. We went to a wolf sanctuary in the middle of the desert with this Native American woman named Tasha. And it was just like all these dope places. And then it was like, yes, finally we get to shoot. There was 8 episodes. We shot 3 the first week. We come in Monday. Everything is happening. They had us shoot the podcast. Me and Tahir shot Internet is Undefeated. Everything was good. All right, team meeting real quick. Brought us all in. CEO was just like, all right, well, I guess this is like a Dearly Beloved. And we was like, huh?
Damn.
Everybody packed their boxes up and walked to the structure. We were all, but what was crazy was that me and the producer on the time, Aaron Sanders, we had to keep shooting the show. So we were shooting on this like ghost production. We had 2 more episodes left. And then the next week, which was the beekeeper and like a couple other cool things, were canceled. But we still had to shoot 2 episodes. So I'm here on set. Me and the producer know All Def is closed. We can't tell anybody. So we got these whole crew sitting down with us like, oh, this is so dope. What's the call time next week?
Damn.
We haven't figured it out. We'll let you know when we build it. Okay.
You're a great producer. Kevin Hart told me this. We was going back and forth. It's on YouTube too. But he was like, the job of a great producer is the bullshit. And so basically, you had to bullshit that crew.
I felt. But the worst part was like, we were getting all these golden moments that I knew would never see the light of day. You know, we would have Tony pick up a baby wolf and say something hilarious. The whole crew would laugh and I'm just dead inside like, oh God. So we shot those 2 episodes. At the end of the second episode, it was a beauty. We just shot with a falconer. The last shot, we were in a giant field with a hawk. It was amazing. I was low-key recording the last shot because I was like, oh, this is low-key the last shot in All Def history. And then I still have it on my phone. And then when we wrapped, I had to gather up everybody and fire everyone. No one did anything wrong. Me and Aaron took Tony to a car and we did it to him. We had to tell him we didn't want to just, because I felt horrible, like especially for him, like I had just shot all this stuff. It's amazing. It's perfectly on brand with what I do and the animals and stuff. And it's just like, we're sorry, but we have to let you guys go. And it was terrifying because I was just like, are they gonna flip the switch on the channel? Because this was like my portfolio, damn near. So I went and got like a $500 G drive that held like 2 terabytes. And I literally copied the entire channel. I went to the post supervisor and I was like, can you just put the entire Comedy Channel on here? It took 3 days, but I came back on that Friday. Everybody was still packing stuff up. I got the drive. I got a couple things out the prop room because everything belonged to the bank. Because I thought like, okay, if I start a production company, I could use some of this stuff. So it was really like, it was really out there. I had a room full of like props, a drive that just had all these projects on it. And I really did not know. So I went kind of crazy. I went business crazy.
I started snorting coke and fucking.
No. Right? The week I got fired, I started a hair product line. I pushed. Luckily, I had started my merch the first time. I thought I'd started thought I was getting fired. So I started pushing that. Me and Tahir immediately called each other up and was like, do you want to keep this podcast going? But now we own it, which was the best thing that happened, probably out of everything, was the transfer of ownership of things like podcasts and stuff.
Right.
But yeah, we just kept it going. I almost started another channel called Fan Network with Rito and Utz and that and those guys. We were like working out of this little production company, but it just never came together. But yeah, it was never really like a downtime. I tried to keep my mind off of it by just like working and staying afloat. But it was great because that downtime allowed me to really take ownership of everything. And now it's just like, yeah, I couldn't imagine being in that situation I was in a year and a half ago, because this being on your own and working on your own and owning all your stuff, it's like I don't know if I could ever go back.
yeah, but don't. you got to own that shit. T.I. came into play then. So y'all got shut down. What was that conversation? Did T.I. personally come in and be like, what the fuck? Or did some... Who reached out to who to get ADD back up and running?
So everything that you're seeing right now, you can attribute to Culture Genesis. Culture Genesis is a Black-owned tech company that had been doing this show with all deaf talent. They never booked me, but there was a show called Trivia Mob that they were using like a lot of all deaf talent. And this was probably like within the last year before we closed. So they were already kind of getting in with that that space, and they were already they were tech, so they were kind of already in the business mind. I don't know how much they worked with like content, like how we're doing now before Trivia Mob, but yeah, they pretty much were the most attractive offer, because I guess a couple people made offers to buy All Deaf, but you know, shout out to the people in the last regime who made that decision, because they felt like it made the most sense to go with a Black-owned company. Because like we had like weird offers, like Black like news outlets, like not the Shade Room, but like websites like the, or companies like the Shade Room that are like journalists. And it was just like, what would All Deaf become if it went that route, you know? So
right.
Culture Genesis made the most sense, and they're really good about going out and getting funding and talking to people, and they're just always making moves. So I remember I was one of the partners, the CEO, Cedric, he invited me to meet with T.I.'s boy from Grand Hustle and like Baron Davis, you know, just like to meet the new investors. I never really knew any of the investors in the last regime, but yeah, they're very, very involved. But that was all Culture Genesis. And T.I. has been really dope in like reposting and jumping in stuff. And he's like really excited, like, It's super dope, because I grew up, you know, he's a Rubber Band Man, and you know, in eighth grade we were bumping King back to back to back to back to back, and now it's just like he's like this, you know, like, you know, jumping in Roast Me, and it's like it's just, right. Wow. Shout out to T.I. Although he don't be laughing.
Hey, he's, man, he's a gangster. T.I. I met him one time. He was super cool dude. I always tell people that he was up for Rush Hour. It was between me and him for Rush Hour. And I think a shooting happened outside of one of his shows. And CBS is like, no, let's go with somebody safe. And that's how I booked the show.
From a different life, because he wasn't giving me nothing, and I was giving him gold on dad jokes.
You what? Hey, bro, I saw that episode. That shit was hilarious. You was giving him gold, and he wasn't laughing, man.
I get why, because I was like, I talked to him off camera. I was like, what does make you laugh? And he said the time that brought him up on a time that he – was dying laughing. He said there was a time where his homie got shot in the leg and was kind of like acting like a bitch. And he said that T.I. couldn't stop laughing. And I was like, that's what makes you laugh? Niggas is too gangster, man. I can't.
So is he technically like y'all boss? Like, I mean, can he be like, no, don't do that shit, and we not doing that, and stuff like that?
I don't know how that works. I don't know how that works at all.
Right.
I don't know how that works.
Hey, but well, he provided money.
I could imagine if he said he doesn't want to do something, then yeah, for sure. But I don't really know. I don't know how that works.
Gotcha. Not fair yet. And you don't want to get shot. So Where do you see the future for yourself, and where do you see the future for ADD?
For all deaf, we saw a comment that was, I saw it myself, but it was so dope that it was screenshot and sent to me by, you know, the CEO and a few other people. It was, all deaf is what BET was supposed to be. Damn. And that's kind of like full circle why I brought that up first. That's, you know, I don't think we were there yet, you know, but that's how I see it. I see us being the hub of not only our culture, but other cultures who are interested in our culture. Mm. And I think that how we do that is very, very, strategic and important, because there was a long period of time where all deaf was not a good look for our culture. You know, there was a period of time where, you know, it started off, our big shows was for the first time in Is It True? And it started off interesting because it was a play on stereotypes and race cultures. It would be like Black people try traditional African food for the first time, or like, you know, like, trying to prove different like stereotypes wrong. But once we got through all the interesting stuff, it became very, very gimmicky. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Is it true? Black people have the biggest penis. That was an actual video that was shot. Mm. It was just very, very like, it got too much. And I'd like to say
I'm glad you told me that, because I was about to pull my dick out to prove to admit, but I'm not going to do it now.
No, I wouldn't even know how to explain that. That screenshot. But I'd like to say that I had vision of this for a very long time, because there was a point in time where we went out and did Black people go hiking for the first time. Mm-hmm. And that was my ceiling. I was like, I hike all the time. It's ridiculous. So I remember I stood up, and I'm not trying to make it seem like I'm Troy or anything, but like I stood up in a meeting, because we had these meetings where we would spitball like the next for the first time or the next Is It True? And I asked everybody, I was like, do you guys feel like we're doing too much now? You know, I feel like this race thing is kind of played out. How would you guys feel if we started doing content that was just focused on not being racially funny, but just funny? Mm. And the reason why that was an important moment was I saw the relief of everybody. And it was almost like everybody sort of felt that way. And I was always in tune with the editors, because they weren't biased. They were just like, just give me something to edit and I'll edit it and just pay me, right? Everybody in the brainstorm was like, yeah, I was there for the development. Like, let's do it, let's do it. It takes an outside voice to be like, this is kind of dumb, you know? So, and the editors started saying like, yo, thank you for saying that, blah, 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 blah. I started like having a lot of mini conversations with people who felt the same way. And then I saw the channel's tone change. And then I saw the editors laughing while they were editing and saying that this is really good and stuff that they would watch at home. Cause like everybody at these companies don't watch the channel. You know what I mean? Like Absolutely. A lot of those, like, especially like Awesomeness TV, like some of those things was, I don't know if I can say that, but some of these things were bordering pedophilia. Like there was like this little cheerleader camp of like these middle schoolers that were dancing and stretching and not barely wearing. I was just like, ew, I wouldn't watch this. Like, so that's why everybody wanted to watch, to work at All Deaf. And when All Deaf separated from Awesomeness, we started seeing everybody from Awesomeness come over, because it was like, yeah, I want to do the cool stuff that right. I would watch outside of work. So it was really just about keeping that. So yeah, ideally, just to answer the question, I kind of want it to be as big and as interesting as BET used to be.
Do you think it's, I always ask people that's very heavy on social media, how important do you feel TV is to what you're trying to do, or is it obsolete to what you're trying to do?
Here's the thing. Everybody grew up wanting to be on TV. Nobody grew up wanting to be on YouTube, because anybody can upload a YouTube. It's all about exclusivity. But my whole outlook on that changed when we got the numbers of television. Now, you know all of this stuff, but you know social media numbers, how crazy they can get, right? Mm-hmm. We were told that a good premiere on television that wasn't like a huge thing on regular TV like American Idol, just like a regular cable station, a good premiere would have anywhere between 50 and 70,000 viewers.
Wow.
So in our mind, we're like, that's a bad video.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, that's a bad performing video to us. So in my mind, I'm like, everybody's watching the internet now. You look at kids, they're on YouTube, on the iPads, they're watching YouTube. This is the new that, but we didn't grow up thinking that. So the prestigious part of us wants the TV credit, the movie credit, which is good. I still think that people should get that. I love that. But it's like I'm seeing the power of social media is not only rivaling those numbers, but blowing them out the water in a lot of ways. Right. So attention-wise, it's winning. But, you know, in terms of how the industry's set up and, like, you know, if you have a movie credit, you're this, this, and that. But I remember, like, even CP, comedian CP, Chris Powell on All Def, who's like
very funny comedian, CP.
The new crowd favorite. He went with us to Vegas because we threw him in a shoot. It was a new show I had. It was like a show where two teams play rock, paper, scissors in a new city, and then whoever loses is broke in the city, and whoever wins gets to, like, experience all the best.
Right? So, that's dope.
Yeah, thank you. It was a really good time, but CP had a moment with me where he was like, I get it now. You know what I mean? I spent so much time worried about being on TV and the TV credit and stuff like that, but walking around with you guys in Vegas, like, he saw that people were watching the channel, you know what I mean, from just like how often we were being stopped. So he talks about it with me all the time. He says he always says, I remember Vegas is when it's almost like he realized that he was like, okay, I feel like I should be on the channel more. It was almost like his thinking shifted from the old way of thinking, like, I gotta be here, I gotta make these moves to be on TV and stuff. Which, and you know, he's obviously still making those moves, but right. Sees the value of social media. And sometimes you just kind of have to see it, because if it's hard to explain that something is on YouTube doing great, like, it's hard to explain almost, you know.
I'm definitely gonna hit y'all ass up and slide in some of y'all videos one of these days. I mean, I'm on fucking CBS and it's like no one knows you. It's so weird. Let me tell you how I fucked up, because like I said, I was on YouTube and I got off YouTube, then I saw Spoken Reasons booked the movie The Heat from being off of YouTube. So I was like, let me get back on YouTube. So yeah. I did this video. Teddy Ray was actually in it, this BET hip hop cypher spoof I used to do back in the day. And okay. Teddy played Rick Ross and I played Kendrick Lamar, and that shit was good. And
I guess I could see you pulling off of Kendrick.
Oh yeah. I did Kendrick. I did too. We did them 2 years in a row. But let me tell you how I fucked up and dropped the ball. I used to open up for Afion Crockett. And we in some city, and we in Foot Locker. And some people was like, hey, man, you the dude from Vine. And I was like, these motherfuckers, I'm on goddamn MTV. That's what I'm thinking, because I'm so accustomed to trying to be a TV dude. And so I'm like, man, yeah. I'm thinking in my mind, like, goddamn it, I got to get on Vine. If niggas know me for Vine, instead of realizing, like, no, this is the future. This is the way shit is going.
Right. You know,
but I literally just had Spoken Reasons on, and I said this to Batch, what King Batch also one time, like, why do y'all still try to get on TV if your Instagram videos is getting fucking 5 million views? It's like, right. and I remember Batch told me, he was like, well, it's almost like getting your verification check. Like, people know that, like, you legit. That's what he said. And this was like maybe 3-4 years ago when he said this. So his attitude his thinking on that may have changed now, but that's what he had told me then. But I just always see it, and that's why I, like, admire what y'all are doing so much, because, you know, y'all are being yourselves, y'all creating this content, y'all not waiting on anybody, and y'all are getting stuff done and y'all making a name. My only thing is now is, when do you think the money is going to catch up to TV? Because being on CBS, I get paid very well. You see what I'm saying? But y'all have the people behind y'all.
Yeah.
Which I ultimately think is even more important. Mm-hmm. So when do you feel like the money may catch up to what these networks and streaming services are doing?
You know, it's hard to say, because everybody on social media is using a different approach, you know? The reason why I don't care about what Batch said he cared about in terms of like the verification is he's coming at it from as an actor, right? So as an actor, you audition to get into these projects, right? You audition to get these opportunities, right? That's what acting is. I don't care about that because social media taught me to make what I want, right? So, I remember I used to do commercial acting in college because like I tried everything. And I remember how I felt in those audition rooms. And it was so fake, you know? And I just, not fake in the terms of like acting like somebody else, but just the whole like, hey, what's up, casting director?
Agreed.
This remote is a sword, you know, like I didn't like it. And even the whole like behind the table, like, okay, cool. You know, like and so when I started auditioning and having the control and understanding, it was like, okay, now I don't take any offense to what happens in a casting room because it's all about the project. Everybody is all about them. If I messed up or whatever, instead of thinking about the project. So now that I know how to make stuff and create my own things, that's really all I want to do. So it's like, if I can shoot somebody's stand-up special and put it on a platform where 500,000 to a million people see it, and I made it and own it, I would much rather that than putting it on like a Netflix. They take 75%, you know, 30,000 people watch it, you know, like if it's always going to, it's going to be a longer road, but I think that's when the money catches up and you see like people like Kev on stage making moves where he's getting some pretty legitly crazy numbers on these virtual stand-up shows. So it's like, what's the next move? Do you keep it and own it and just make boatloads of money? Or do you look for that verification and give it to a Netflix, you know? So now it's like, you're on that Netflix, you get that check and both checks right. and being validated. Maybe both is important, I don't know. But in my mind, I just want to make what I want to make. And I'm not really focused on trying to get in. I would love to do collabs and getting in other people's projects, but that's not my only route, you know?
Right. And so this is the last question, man. So where do you personally want to see your career 5 to 10 years from now?
I would like, I feel like what I need is a creative campus that I can basically put all of my interests into one so that I can not only make my own ideas come alive, but other upcoming people's ideas come alive within those boundaries. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? So if I can have some type of outlet to do scripted content, you know, I'll never stop doing free content for the internet. You know, I think that's really, really important. I made that promise a long time ago.
Dope.
So I'll probably always be in that field, but you know, scripted content, you know, live shows, gaming, music, food, literally just creating. And I think that's what's dope about social media that we didn't really have when we had cable, is that cable was this, 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 and this, and you had to do something within those boundaries. But social media is just like, boom, here's a channel. And if you can get people to come, it's whatever you want. It's literally like, if you start a YouTube channel, people don't realize this, you are a channel executive
right.
of programming. You know, it could literally be whatever you want. And people have proven that it's not a waste of time financially by a long shot. So it really just depends on what you want. That's really what it comes down to. It's like the end goal, because if you want to act and jump into stuff for Netflix, that's super dope, you know, but you could also act in your own stuff on your own channel and get a similar check if you work hard enough.
Straight up. Hey, man, Patrick Cloud, man, I appreciate you, bro. This has been a very fascinating episode, man. It was everything that I hope it would be. Very interesting, very educational. And I appreciate you. And like I said, man, I started this platform to celebrate people I consider living legends and people making legendary moves, man. And I could only, I'm just excited to see where your career and your journey takes you, man, because I know it's nothing but greatness, and even bigger things that's on the horizon for you, man. So you're a king, bro. And just keep doing your thing.
I appreciate it, man. I appreciate this platform a lot. I think this is really what the culture needs, and celebrating each other is very dope. So I applaud you for that. This is really, really cool.
Hey, man, I appreciate that, man. Well, keep doing your thing, bro. I'll holler at you.
Absolutely.
Peace.